Going Linux, episode 237, listener feedback. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy.
And I'm your co-host, Bill.
Whether you are new to Linux, upgrading from Windows to Linux, or just thinking about moving to Linux, this podcast will provide you with valuable information and advice that will help you in going Linux.
We hope that you find this and all our episodes helpful in learning about Linux and its applications and using them to get things done. In today's episode, listener feedback.
If you want to send us feedback, our email address is goinglinux@gmail.com and our voicemail line is 1-904-468-7889. Hello, Bill. Welcome back to the show. As always, brand new month, March 2014. The year is going by very quickly, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And you know what today is?
Today, the actual day we're recording this, not the day we release it, is your birthday.
That's right.
Happy birthday.
Survived another year. Yay.
Yeah. And we're recording this a little ahead of time. So
yes,
the beginning of March is not Bill's birthday, but you can wish him a birthday wish, 2 weeks ago?
Yes. Okay, Larry, I'm going to let you, we've got something that it's a little different for our banter, and I'll let you take it from here.
Okay. Well, we have an update on Tom for longtime listeners to the show. From 2007 to 2012, Tom appeared regularly on the show as my co-host on this Going Linux podcast. It wasn't until April of 2013 that we actually announced Tom's retirement from the show without any real explanation. Many of you have asked for an update on Tom, and we've read a hi to Tom during our feedback show quite often. It is only recently that we've received permission from Tom's brother, Dan, to let you know how he's doing.
Here is the email from Dan in February. He writes, "Folks, for those who have wondered what happened to Tom, here is the update. Tom suffered irreversible brain damage about a year ago. Very sad. He is now living comfortably at a home in Sulksville, Wisconsin. Tom has little or no recollection of you, as he has a form of amnesia. His last 10 years or so have been erased. Bill, he amazingly still remembers your name. Tom is being retrained to walk. His long-term memory is very good, and he can remember just about anything prior to 2003. He is shocked to learn of his age, which is 61, so we don't bring it up to him. Should you have inquiries, you can direct them here. Thanks for being Tom's friends. Should you choose to mention him in a podcast, I would appreciate a link. Feel free to publish or broadcast my email address. I will answer all inquiries, as long as the subject line includes Tom. Best, Dan, Tom's brother."
And Dan's email address is danchadwar, which is how I pronounce it, at hotmail.com. And that's DanChadoir at hotmail.com. And make sure the subject line reads either Tom or Tom, Choudoir, when addressing the emails to Dan. And I'm sure that Dan will be prompt in responding to your email inquiries or just comments about Tom. So if you do have any best wishes for Tom, send them directly to Dan, his brother. And I'm sure that Dan will get those comments over to Tom and best wishes. So we wish Tom all the best. And I'm not going to put Dan's email address on our website because our website gets crawled by all kinds of things. And I don't want Dan getting a lot of spam messages. About the only place you'll have his email address is here on the audio podcast. So if you're going to the website to try to figure out what his email address is, You're not going to find it there. Just listen again to the introduction to episode 237, and you'll be able to get Dan's email address from here.
Thanks, Dan, for allowing us to share this update with our listeners. We appreciate it.
Okay, and with that, shall we get into our show?
I think we should.
Okay, listener feedback. What's up first, Bill?
Okay, our first feedback is from Door to Door Geek about Swap Space. And he sent us a voice mail, so let's give that a listen right now.
Okay, here we go.
Hello, Larry. Hello, Bill. Hey, Tom. Door to Door Geek, a.k.a. Steve McLaughlin. Swap Space, Ram, last show, or two shows ago, I want to say. Listener feedback. Now, I'm sorry, no. You only need more swap space than you have physical RAM if you want to hibernate your computer. That's the only reason to have more swap space than RAM. That's it. Nothing else. Nothing else. You can prefer to have it. Now, here's the only time. Here's the way I said this should go, and I've seen Wikipedia articles, and I've listened to people, and this seems like a general good rule of thumb. There is no perfect way, but starting at around 256 megs of RAM, you should have two times the RAM. Once you hit around 4 gigs of RAM, you should barely have more swap space than you have RAM, because there's a cost benefit, and it declines over the amount of RAM and the amount of swap. It makes no sense to have 16 gigs of RAM and a 32 gig swap space for 99.999% of all users. I'm sure there's some database server needs where that's a really optimal configuration, but those are very niche needs. But today, in our normal RAM levels, 2 gig, 4 RAM, 4 gig, 6 gig, 8 gig, you don't need twice as much as there is physical RAM. It's complete waste. You see no cost benefit. You see no speed improvement. And if you take a look at most swap space being used on most people's computers today, it's not being utilized. It just isn't being used. We're lucky if we use 2 to 3 gigs of RAM in our normal daily operation. Podcasters have different needs. Hardcore video editors have different needs. Hardcore sound editors have different needs. We all have our own stuff. But the only reason to have more swap space than RAM is for hibernation. All right, guys. Keep up the good work.
Well, thanks, Dor, for that explanation. Pretty emphatic. The only real reason you need additional swap space more than your RAM is for hibernation.
Yeah,
and we had actually also received that same comment from Carlos, another listener, and I mentioned that on the last Computer America episode. So, Carlos, thank you for your input, and Dor, thanks for yours as well.
Yeah, thanks, Dor. And that's why, Larry, I usually just let the installer pick what it wants, and it usually just works.
Yep, absolutely. Yep. Unless you're doing Arch or...
One of those.
Well,
right now, I've got Ubuntu, so, it's like keep it simple, stupid, which is the good advice for me because I like to blow things up.
Yep.
Yep. Okay.
We've heard that. Anyway.
Yeah. So what's the next one, Larry?
Okay. Our first email is a long one. This one's from Andrew. We're going to break this up into two parts. I'll read the first part, okay?
Okay.
All right. And Andrew's providing his response to the file system question that was posed in episode 234. Hi, Larry and Bill. I thought I would respond to your request to know the differences between some of the file systems that people are likely to come across. EXT4, or Extended 4, is the default for most Linux installs and is the fourth iteration of Linux's own file system. It's a journaling file system, which basically works by keeping track of the changes that will be made before committing them to the main file system. After the changes are made, then the file table is updated to reflect the new information. In the event of a system crash or power failure, the system is more likely to be recovered to a usable state and less likely to become corrupt, in that you may have lost the file being saved at the time, but the rest of the disk should be fine. EXT4 also randomizes the file locations about the disk to prevent file fragmentation. The next one is BTRFS, or B-Tree File System, or oftentimes pronounced ButterFS or BetterFS. It's a copy-on-write file system. This basically means that new information is saved in a location on the disk, then the file table reference is adjusted to point to the new location. In this manner, if a system crash or power failure occurs, all but the latest information is saved. This is due to the original information not being overwritten by the new information and remains intact until the file table pointer is changed. The downside of this type of file system is that to make a 1 kilobyte addition to a 10 gigabyte file, you need 10.1 gigabytes or more of free space to save the new file to, whereas EXT4 and NTFS will simply overwrite the original file, adding on the new information in place. This can cause issues as your disk becomes full and new information cannot easily be saved to the disk. ZFS or ZFS has been slow to Linux due to its licensing, CDDL, not being, I'm not sure what CDDL means, but apparently that's the license, not being in line with the requirement of all Linux kernel modules being GPL. Well, that is my understanding. It operates much like ButterFS in the sense that it is also copy-on-write file system. The added benefit is with scale. ZFS is a file system and volume manager in one. It can replace RAID and enable you to have redundancy as well as volumes spanning multiple disks. With Zpools or Zpools, you can band a set of disks together in a RAID-like configuration. And if your storage requirements expand, you can expand your storage by simply adding another Zpool to your array. This makes it easy to expand your storage arrays why it is so popular in enterprise. Alan from TechSnap and BSD Now podcasts talks about ZFS a lot, so he is the go-to guy for more on that one.
Okay, the second part of Andrew's email continues with FAT16 and FAT32 are evolutions of the FAT file system to gradually enable such features as longer file names and larger file sizes. As they do not allow for the additional file information required by Unix-like OSs, such as file ownership, etc., they cannot be used as a system partition for a Unix-like OS, but can be used for general file storage. They do not have the additional drawback of saving files from the beginning of the disk and working progressively out. This eventually leads to fragmented files when a file near the start of the disk changes or is deleted. FAT32 is recommended for USB sticks storing files under 4 gigabytes in size due to its compatibility across most devices. NTFS is not too dissimilar from the FAT family, as it is from the same parent, but is more modern and does include a journaling feature, as well as support for much larger file sizes. Still not overly recommended, though. Only recommended on drives or partitions you need to share with a Windows install, such as in a dual boot configuration or a USB stick, where you are likely to have files larger than the 4 gigabyte limit of FAT32. However, it may not be recognized by all devices. Most external hard disks will be formatted NTFS. Good luck with PC BSD, Bill. I think I will do the same just for fun. Andrew from Perth, Australia. And he has a PS. He says, PS, loving the new look of the website, Larry. It is very clean and easy to read and find what you are looking for. A suggestion is to have the links in the show notes open a tab so people don't lose their place on the going Linux page. All right, Andrew. Just want to add one thing, Larry. The CDDL is what they call a Common Development and Distribution License.
Okay, and it sounds like it's not open source, or not compatible with the GPL, at least.
It is an open source license, but it's I don't think it is compatible. I think there's some differences.
Yeah, and one other thing on NTFS is, be careful using that under Linux because you don't have file ownership. And if you're using an NTFS drive for your backups on Linux, when you restore them, all your file ownership and permissions vanish because NTFS doesn't store them. So if you have a network-attached storage drive and or a USB drive or some other drive that you're using exclusively for Linux backups, first thing I would do with that is to reformat it with one of the Linux file systems that Andrew mentions in his email here. And EXT4 seems to be the most common and most standard these days. And that's what I would use. And that's what I do use. And the only time I would format something NTFS is if I need it compatible with a Windows XP or Windows 7 or 8 computer.
Do you do anything different with your Linux files, or you just take the default?
I just take the default.
Default, okay.
Yeah, whatever that is for that particular operating system. And for Ubuntu and Mint, it's EXT4. And years ago, it used to be EXT3, and I just take that.
Let me ask you a quick question. Can Windows read EXT4?
No, it can read EXT2 with an add-on program. It can't write to EXT2, but it can read. But that's it. And I think it might actually be able to read EXT3 as well with that same add-in. But no, EXT4 is out.
That's bizarre because Linux sure does read a lot of file systems.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course.
Okay.
As far as the links on the website, Andrew, we've had complaints both ways. For a little while there, I actually had the links open in a new page. And some people complained about that, and some people complain, as you've done, not that you're complaining, you're providing a suggestion, that they open in place. And I made the decision a couple of years ago to stop making the links so that they automatically open in a new page, because you can right-click on any one of the links on our website, and you can choose to open it in a new page if you wish, and that just gives you freedom of choice. And that's what we're all about here. Yep. Okay. Next email is a nice short one from Len. Len wrote with a correction for our show notes. Speaking of show notes, hi, Larry. I saw on your show notes for 233, Linux equivalents for business episode, you have listed at 22 minutes and 49 seconds tethering DSLR cameras, Untangled. I believe the name of the software is Entangled. Here's the link, entangled-photo.org. As always, thanks for the shows. And yes, Len, I did make a mistake in the show notes. It was mentioned correctly in the podcast audio. So I went back and changed the show notes at your suggestion, and everything is fixed.
You made a mistake. I'm docking your pay and sending you home early.
Okay. Bye.
Okay. Bye. Well, wait a minute. Come back here.
Okay. All right.
Our next email is from Paul, and he asks about systemd. And he writes, Larry and Bill, I would be interested in your opinion of the proposed Debian redesign of systemd. What is it and how would it impact Linux Mint? I have included a clip, 7 minutes or so, of the Mintcast program where the subject is discussed, but I don't understand the subject or implication to Linux Mint. The audio is only for your reference and not intended for rebroadcast. Here's the link here, I believe. And he gives us the link. Frankly, all I want to do is use email, store photos, watch YouTube, use Audacity, and store audio files. In other words, I just want my computer to work. I don't expect you to reply in email, but your opinions would be interesting future program material, I believe. Thanks anyways, Paul in North Texas.
Well, Paul, thanks for the link to the article, which is on lwn.net. And it's talking about the init system for Debian. It goes into some discussion there. And in fact, I just listened to the Linux Mint episode that you were referring to, Paul, regarding their opinions on systemd versus other possibilities. So a little background. Linux Mint is a distribution that is based on Ubuntu, or you have the Debian edition that's based directly on Debian. Ubuntu is based on Debian as well. And all of these systems use something that is an initial program that runs after you've started the boot process of Linux that initializes the system. And that's why it's called init. And what it does is it allows the system to begin starting up, and it starts all of the services in turn of things like wireless connection or your display driver. It's basically the thing that gets your system up and running. It's kind of a, as they described on the Mintcast, it used to be a bunch of scripts, and they've been put into this initialization system. And there's been some discussion amongst the Ubuntu folks as to, hey, we should be changing to something else. And the Debian folks have been discussing, what should we be using here? Should we be replacing the traditional init system that we've been using forever? And I haven't been following it in any great depth or detail. But it looks like Debian has made a decision as to what it's going to do, which in turn drives the Ubuntu decision as to what it's going to do. And for the first time in history that I can remember, Ubuntu has relented and said, we're not going to go off and do something and design something on our own. We're actually going to follow what Debian is doing. And as far as the implications for Linux Mint are concerned, Linux Mint is going to follow what Debian does anyway. They've made it very clear through their actions that they take whatever Ubuntu does with a little bit of a grain of salt, and they don't necessarily follow strictly everything that Ubuntu does, especially in those desktops that don't involve Unity. And so I wouldn't be surprised if they had already, before this announcement was concerned, decided to go with whatever direction Debian decided to go. So as for implications for the future for Linux Mint, it's all invisible to the average user. Don't worry about it. If you're using Linux Mint, you're probably using it because you don't want to have to worry about all this back-end computer-ish programming type stuff, and it'll all work under Linux Mint, it'll all work under Ubuntu, and it'll all work under Debian. You don't have to worry about it. That's the implication. Yeah.
Well, I just want to, if you want some interesting reading, another one is Mark Shuttleworth. I actually posted a great article on his website. I'll put his blog address in the show notes if you'd be interested, because he goes in and discusses the system to redesign.
Yep.
It's very interesting.
Yeah. Always interesting reading if you're interested in that kind of
detailed
stuff. But again, if you're a Linux Mint user, maybe you're not. You know, maybe you just want it to work. And with Linux Mint, it does.
Okay. Well, I'm trying to get my fanboy cred, okay?
All right. Sounds good.
Okay. Okay. We had a comment on Google Plus from John. I have noticed that a lot of fixes in Linux involve editing configuration files from the terminal, often during boot. This is not a trivial thing for very new users. Perhaps you could devote at least a short segment to this topic. Or if I have missed this on a previous show, could anyone point me to the episode? Have we talked about that?
No, we haven't really. Some of the articles we have talk about editing various files. in order to get things done, in order to get things to work properly, or in order to change the way things work, like our article on setting up an SSD drive. There were some configuration files that we suggested you edit to optimize your system for SSD if it didn't come with a solid state drive. So yeah, these are some things that we can cover. Maybe we can cover them from the perspective of these are the system files that you're most likely to need to edit under certain circumstances, discuss those circumstances. And these are the ones you want to shy away from editing unless you know what you're doing because it can bork your system, those kinds of things. So I like that as a possible show idea.
Yeah. Yeah, because Bill has messed up those type of things before. And believe me, you can mess it up and kill the whole system.
Yeah. And one way to get around killing your whole system, and you know, this is always good advice before you edit any file, make a backup copy of it.
What fun would that be?
Make a copy with exactly the same name and then put .bak or .copy at the end of it just so you have it. And then worst case is your system will absolutely not boot. So you pop in a live USB stick or a live DVD and go in and delete the file you just edited and rename your backup copy back to the original one. And then you should be able to reboot, provided
that's
you
no
didn't
fun.
Make other changes. I know. But that's one way to get around it. All right. Our last email is from Paul, who suggests a topic. Larry and Bill, who fixes Linux? Is that a problem? And should Linux Mint users be concerned? And he provides a link to an article on FossForce.com written by Ken Starks. Who fixes Linux? Well, when you go through Ken's article, he does a little bit of a rant about people not maintaining the links to fixes or settings and those kinds of things. And who fixes this stuff is kind of his point of view. And yeah, bottom line is, as far as the documentation on Linux is concerned, that's always a situation that's difficult. Because people like to do development work. They like to work on new stuff. And to document the way things currently work, and especially to go back and fix the documentation so that it references the way things work now, not the way they worked in 2004, is a little bit of drudgery work. And very few people like doing that. And that's the kind of thing where we need more people to help out in the open source community. So if you're the kind of person that actually likes getting in and doing copy editing, as they call it, on help files and on website documentation and on manuals for Linux and Linux applications, this is a great way to get yourself involved in the Linux community, directly helping other Linux users by getting in there and maintaining the documentation. Just pick a project, go for it, and sign yourself up to help with the documentation. They would really, really appreciate that.
They never turn down people that like to write documentation. Never.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thanks, Paul, for a link to Ken's article, and Ken, thanks for writing it. Okay, I think that's it for our episode, Bill.
Actually, I have an application.
Oh, great. What's your application pick this time?
The application, I originally ran across this running PC Linux OS, and I liked it so much, I did a search and found that you can get this from SourceForge, and he has the different RPMs and the 32 DIBs and the 64 DIB packages. So if you do a Google search, you'll pull it right up at SourceForge. Anyway, it's called the Great Little Radio Player. This is a awesome, I just had to say the word, awesome streaming radio player. It has tons of links. It has news. It has sports. It has a big band, it has jazz, blues, you name it, it has it. And you're able to add streams to it, but it has so many, I think the defaults, it has like 600 streams, so you're never going to be without something to listen to. It's really, really easy to use, very straightforward. Get a chance, try it. It's very intuitive, and whoever put this together, I can't remember his name, he did a heck of a great job.
Well, that's great. I'm looking at it on the SourceForge site. We'll have a link in the show notes. And I see that it's also on a Google site as well, so maybe it's part of a Google development effort. But it's on SourceForge. We'll have that link in the show notes, and looks kind of nice.
Yes, it is.
Since yours is around media, let me give you one that will be of interest to the geeks among our audience here. And this is a command line FM radio station with indie music. And it's actually not command line. It simulates a command line in a browser.
Okay.
Yeah. And, this one, let me see here. Open in a new tab in a new window. Yeah. So this one is very interesting. It is CMD, as in command, .fm. You go to that website and you've got a black screen with text.
So it's CMD.fm. Really?
Okay. Yeah, that's it. Yep. Yeah, yep. Yeah. And you get, looks like a BBS interface, right?
Oh, yeah. I see
there
that.
There you go. And if you type the word genres, G-E-N-R-E-S, it comes up with a list of genres. So you pick a genre of music to listen to by typing it in. So if you want to listen to folk music or 80s music or gospel music or indie, I don't know what the difference between J-pop and K-pop are, but they have those. Rap music, anything you want, and it actually begins playing. And it sources this from all over the internet, and I'm sure this works internationally as well as in the U.S., because I've listened to a lot of international music and content on this site. Really interesting, and all you need is a browser.
Okay, so you just had to outdo me. This is cool.
It doesn't have the same pretty interface that yours does.
Well, I like this interface. It's cool.
Yeah, it harkens back to the days of bulletin board systems.
BBSs.
Exactly.
And all I'm going to say is, darn you, I thought I had you. One of these days.
There you go.
All right.
So I'll add both of those to the show notes, and we'll have
that's
them
excellent.
For everybody.
That's awesome. You really got to check that out.
Yeah. Yeah. It's cool. CMD. .fm.
If you just want to see Larry School, his co-host again, just go to that website.
Oh, man. You're too hard on yourself, Bill.
Oh, man. I thought I had the master until the master done smacked me with a 4x4.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Larry. I like that. I'll be playing with that. I wonder if I'll work on my smartphone.
I don't know. I haven't tried it on a smartphone.
Well,
I bet it would.
I'll try it out.
There you go. Let us know next time, Bill.
I will.
Okay. All right. Our next episode will be a Computer America episode number 71. Until then, you can go to our website at goinglinux.com for articles and show notes, as well as links to download and subscribe. We are the website for computer users who just want to use Linux to get things done.
And if you like, you can participate directly with our friendly and helpful community members by joining the discussion in our Going Linux podcast Google Plus community.
Until next time, thanks for listening.
73.
Theme music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.